Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Callum Stoneman and welcome to another Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. Tech Talk is of course our weekly look at what's new and what's going on in the world of technology from a blind and partially sighted perspective. We always love to hear from you, so if you want to get in contact with us, techtalk@rnib.org.uk is our email address. Voice notes or written messages are always welcome. Coming up this week, we'll be hearing about the new Talu accessible payment card. Hubert Pavalkovich demonstrates the Shox Open Dot earbuds. And we'll be doing our best to answer some of those emails that have been coming in as well. Usual team with me this week, Hubert Pavalkovich, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Let's see what's been catching our attention this week. Hubert, anything new with you?
It's kind of one of these things where it shows that people are sometimes right to maybe not upgrade their software straight away to the big releases. So a new update has been issued for iOS users, iOS 26.0.1, and it fixes an issue that is quite crucial for voiceover users. I've experienced this during beta testing, but not during the main release, and that is that if you upgrade, you will either lose a voiceover when the phone restarts after upgrading, or when you next restart your phone, even if you have voiceover when you initially update your software, when you restart your phone next, you could lose voiceover. That's been an issue that has been noticed by quite a few users. Now, this update is very much a fix that fixes mainly that and a few other little bugs, but that one is a big fix for the update. So it's quite nice that Apple have released what to me looks like very much an accessibility-focused update on that issue, because usually you get these releases that fix just a big security flaw sometimes, but this one is nicely focused on fixing a crucial accessibility issue for blind and partially sighted users, which I think is quite nice to see that they've reacted fairly quickly to this.
Yeah, so I was aware of this from, of course, AppleViz were all over this, but it was mentioned in the release notes for the main update itself as well, which always feels... It shouldn't do, but it always just feels a bit weird when
you
see,
we've
fixed an issue with voiceover in the mainstream release notes. Oh, they know us.
It's really nice to see.
Yeah. The thing that made this such a big problem as well was because, so you would lose voiceover when the phone, this is, as far as I understand it, I haven't experienced this, but you would lose voiceover when the phone restarted, and then once you put your passcode in, the speech came back, as far as I understood it. But the problem is, because you're at that first point where essentially everything is still under the encryption that happens when your device is powered off, you can't... the side button, triple-clicking, the side button didn't help. You can't use Siri, because you're not at that level yet. You can't use a Bluetooth keyboard, because again, you're not at that level. The only way you could do it was either to plug in a keyboard via USB-C. It's like going back to the 90s, isn't it? Well, not USB-C, obviously, but a wired keyboard. Or to get sight assistance. And that, of course, means you'd have to give away your PIN as well. So, yeah, not good. Not good, that issue. But yeah, glad to hear it's been fixed. Jackie, what about you this week? Anything from you?
Yeah, the BrailleSense 6 has finally updated its latest firmware to version 3.0. And the main difference is that they've grouped some of the items on the main menu. They've grouped them quite nicely. For example, there is now a tools menu, and in there would be your word processor, your notepad, and your Excel viewer, things that pertain to like everyday tools you would use, they've put in there. There is also a massive update. There is a new browser. They're still retaining the old browser, though, to be honest, I can't imagine why anybody would want to use the old one. It was terrible. But they have got a new web browser now, and it has got a lot more things that we would be used to, such as headings, tables, you know, moving around, navigation, things like that. And there is also a massive update to the word processor, where they've got lots of different elements in it now that you can use, like tables and, you know, formatting. And, you know, there's a lot more to the word processor now. So yeah, some really good bits and bobs in the new software. If you want to update it, you can either download the file offline and you can update it that way, or the best way, probably and the easiest way, is to go online and update it. And you do that going into the utilities menu, upgrade Braille Sense, and you can choose online, and hopefully you'll be able to update and get that 3.0. All the documentation has been updated as well. So the help menu has changed a bit as well. They've put all the different things to do with documentation and information about the unit. They've put all that now in a little help menu, and so it's also had a makeover.
It's funny, isn't it? They all seem to be coming out with these updates now after not really much for a while. The Braille Note has released one recently as well, and now this Braille Sense 6 update as well. Which, yeah, quite a nice set of new features there.
It is. It's good, and I think it was really long overdue because they've been working on the web browser aspect for a long time. I've been one of the beta testers of it for quite a while, and it has really had a massive makeover. You can still use the old one if you want to, but I personally, I never recommended the web browser on the Braille Sense. It was very weak. But this new one, yeah, give it a go and see what you think. It's free, so go for it.
Probably worth just mentioning though that this doesn't update the version of Android that it's running, doesn't it? It's still Android 12 underneath.
That's correct.
But still, very nice updates there. So give that a go if you're a Braille Sense 6 user. Natalie, what's anything caught your eye this week?
Not so much caught my attention, but a couple of things I thought some listeners might be interested in knowing. And the first thing is a couple of weeks ago, I updated to the latest version of JAWS because I think we were all a bit confused by that announcement, and then we did an explainer on this show. So I updated because to be fair, I was running a few years behind. And I have to say, when I phoned up to say this is what I want to do, the lady actually said, I think you'd be better off doing this. And we did some number crunching together and we got the right package in the end. But what I want to say is when I got the email through saying, here's your serial codes and the link to download, blah, 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 I was slightly panicked because it said the authorization code you were given previously should be used for this one as well. And I thought, flip sake, that was years ago. But I needn't have panicked because when I went to download the new version, my previous authorization code had auto-populated. So I needn't have panicked or trying to find it. It was already there and I just had to go hit OK or continue or whatever the button was. And that all went reasonably smoothly. What I wanted to then say was after that, when I closed my laptop and rebooted it, as I suspected might happen, the old version of JAWS trumped the new version and that was still running. So, as on a Windows device, I used the search bar to find Control Panel, tabbed along to, there's literally an option I think called Uninstall Programs, arrowed down to the JAWS old version, I think it was 2021 I was on. And again, this is a bit where I got confused because I went around in circles, literally, trying to find an uninstall button. And actually, what you do is you right click. So if you have an applications key or Shift F10, that brings up the uninstall option. And then you want to, for most people, unless there's a deliberate reason why you don't, you want to leave the box that says, keep my old settings kind of thing. Because you don't have to restart from scratch, you want your settings to transfer over, or at least most people do, and then hit uninstall. And it talks all the way through the end of it. And then because it was the old version of JAWS that was running, once it had done, I had to silently launch the start menu, type in JAWS, and it was a new version that came up. And I thought, it's all very well and good if you're familiar with doing these kind of things in the tech world, but if you're not, that might be helpful to know.
Always makes me nervous doing that update, I've got to be honest, because say you go from like 24 to 25, But as you said, 24 will stay in like the one that starts up when you log in. It will stay as the kind of default, really, until you uninstall it. And I guess they do that so that you've got both versions in case there's any problems. But oh, trying to do that thing of uninstall it. So I tend to get the newer version of JAWS and then uninstall the old version with the new version running. But it is, it's so clunky, is that? It feels like they could do that better.
Yeah, that's why I thought I'd mention it, because it was my first time doing it. So sort of my heart was in my mouth thinking, I hope this works, because there's nobody around if it doesn't. And the other very quick thing I wanted to mention was something I noticed a while back and I thought, that's worth flagging, is if anybody else out there is an Audible user and finds themselves sometimes going through their credits and needing to buy more, be aware that buying more credits in the Audible app costs more than it does on the website. And actually, in some cases, quite a lot more. So I think I bought a bundle of 5 credits, and when I tried to do it on the app, it was something like £32, £33. But on the website, it was like £25, £26. So I thought that's worth, again, sort of just flagging to people.
I've seen a lot of services do this. I think it's because of the kind of the fees that Apple and Google charge for their stores. So yeah, a good tip that. Yeah, try the website. You might get a couple of quid off. You never know.
It works. It seems to work okay if you're buying an actual book. You know, if you see the book and it comes up and it's, you know, £5.99 or whatever, and you decide to pay for it rather than use a credit, that seems to work fine. It was, like I say, specifically if you were trying to buy more credits in the app, I thought, that's quite a significant difference. That's worth me going back to the website and doing it that way.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, a good tip there. So there was an Amazon event last week, which was kind of interesting. We got some new devices from Amazon. So we've got the Echo Dot Max, which is interesting. Because before it was kind of, you had the Echo Dot, which was the little one, the kind of big Echo. And then, of course, you had the Shows, which were the ones with the screen. I think the ones that are going to be most interest to us as blind people are probably the Dot Max. And there was an upgraded Echo Studio as well. But the problem for me is they promise different upgrades, like, you know, better sound and stuff. So I think the Dot Max has got 2 speakers in there now. So stereo audio, basically. I don't know how that affects stereo pairing. So I don't know if you can pair 2 of those. I think that, I don't really know how that would work. But the issue that I have is because these are all new devices, but the big talk with Alexa at the minute is this Alexa Plus, which is essentially an AI version of Alexa. There's still no news on when that's coming to the UK. So I believe it is coming out of beta and slowly rolling out, but still US only. So apart from better sound, I don't honestly know what these new devices give us, to be honest. At least here in the UK.
And it costs £50 more than my Echo Dot 4th gen cost. So
that's another surprising thing as well, the price. Because the Echo range have historically been ridiculously cheap. I mean, a Dot used to start at, what, £50? But then Amazon were doing sales every 2 minutes. So you quite often get one for £25, £30, sometimes even less on, like, Prime Day. You could get one for, I think I picked up one for about £15 once. But yeah, starting price of around about £100 now. I'm sure Amazon will do sales and they'll come down a bit.
Sorry, well, they are having another sale, aren't they, this week, 7th, 8th of October. So that was probably a tactical move on their part.
Busy week, as always. Cheers, guys. Stick with us. This is Tech Talk. A new type of accessible payment card could be hitting your pocket very soon. Howell Davies has been hearing all about the new Talu card.
Now, for many people, making a payment with your credit or debit card may not be an accessible experience, but there's a new card which is aiming to enhance accessibility and make financial services more accessible to everyone. Joining me now from Talu Card is founder Sam Morgan. Sam, welcome into RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us, Sam, what is Talu Card? How is it different to other cards that might be in someone's wallet right now?
TaluCard really is all about bringing an inclusive solution to everybody. That's the objective of the product. But what we realized so far when we've been working on the innovation of the product is that when you and I, who are able, could go and make a payment at a terminal, we understand what we're buying and how much we're paying for something in real time when we're making that payment. I mean, ultimately, that's what making a payment is. But what we realized was that there is a slight unbalance in the landscape, in the sense that if you're visually impaired and you're making a payment, you can't actually identify what brand of product you're paying for and how much you're paying for in real time unless you ask somebody for assistance. So TaluCard was developed really to enable those with disabilities to have that same information. So really it's all about information, giving somebody the same information at that time of payment so that they can understand what they're paying for and how much they're paying.
And describe a TaluCard. What is it? How is it different to other cards?
Well, first of all, it's a physical card, but it's slightly different because it's a biometric card. So the biometric card allows an individual to pair their thumb to the card so that every time that they make a payment, they don't have to put the security of a PIN into that transaction. The fingerprint is verified instantly and is secure, so therefore they will never get prompted for a PIN.
Sam, could you give us an idea of what a transaction is like when using a TaluCard?
So basically, I'm going into Marks and Spencers. I'm going to spend £25 on a wool jumper, but I don't know that I'm going to be doing that unless I ask the cashier. I'm going to represent my biometric card. Now, my app is configured to say anything over £20 is going to ask me to use the two-step process. So the jumper is over £20. The first payment using my fingerprint will be declined as a biometric fail. Then there'll be audio feedback that will come back to me as the user that will say, you're about to spend £25 in Marks and Spencers. The user can say, oh, actually, yes, that's fine. That's what I want to spend. And then the user represents their card for a second transaction and asks the cashier to re-enter the £25. And at that point, then they have the same information that you and I would have when we go and pay for a jumper that's £25, except we already know it's £25. They didn't know that.
And how did you come up with the idea behind TaluCard? Why was this important to you?
Well, we're working in the accessibility field at the moment, and I work with another founder who's obviously very passionate about accessibility and innovation. And we just realized that there wasn't anything in financial services that allowed those who were visually impaired to make a payment without having the barriers to entry with regard to the PIN. I know that we've got Apple Pay, but Apple Pay is on a device, as we know. Not everybody has an expensive device, you know, or the knowledge to use the software on the device to make payments accessible. So I know that Apple and Microsoft have all made huge developments this year with regards to their accessibility features on their phones. But I think what we were trying to consider was the fact that the physical card really entered a market whereby individuals could make a payment without a PIN and not have to worry about on the sixth attempt of on a point of sale machine of somebody being asked for their PIN. And obviously, if you're visually impaired and you've got a queue of people behind you, you feel uncomfortable enough anyway. And research has already told us that a lot of these people, they'll make payments through Amazon or from home, but they won't necessarily go to the shop because payments aren't accessible. So we really tried to think out of the box to move towards the future of biometrics, to understand that if somebody didn't have a phone with them and they wanted to just make a payment with their card, they would never have any of that friction when they get to the terminal. They would just be able to make that secure payment instantly through the fingerprint verification of the biometric card.
And what's the testing process been like for TaluCard? Have you been working with blind and partially sighted people in the developmental stage?
Yeah, well, we have been working quite closely with the RNIB, and yes, we have been testing it with the visually impaired. And the main issues that we've come across is that for somebody that's pairing their card at point of enrolling their fingerprint, you know, that's a challenging process because again, you know, somebody that's visually impaired can't see when there's two ways of verifying your fingerprint on the product. One is through a card reader and one would be through an app. We've gone through some live tests to actually see that there's a huge challenge just enabling somebody that's visually impaired to enroll their fingerprint successfully onto a product without having the assistance of a companion person there to help them. And after the research that we've done, we found that a lot of these people, rather than having a companion managing their funds, they actually want to be independent. So the objective of Tally with the biometric is really to get them to be able to enroll their fingerprint on the card successfully, to make them uniquely independent when they can go to a shop and make a payment as an individual.
Well, where are you on the journey with TaluCard now? What comes next for you, Sam?
Well, we've done a lot of work on the app. We've worked very closely with the RNIB to push the product through. We're going through the tried and tested program at the moment, but we've had such valuable feedback because ultimately the resources that we've spent and the costs that we've spent on the project and getting the project to market, there's no point in actually funding the card unless we know the technology works. So the back end of the technology with regard to the biometric, with the tactile guidance markers, with the enrollment and with the usability of the registration within the application process, we've tried to align everything with the RNIB to make sure that we're going to tick off all those boxes before we go to, you know, production.
And you mentioned some of the feedback that you've had so far. What are some of the issues that blind and partially sighted people have told you that they encounter with payment systems? What do you hear most often?
Well, most often, again, is that they don't remember their PIN, or they don't want to be not understanding what they're paying for when they're paying for it. So if a cashier said to them, can you enter the PIN, and they've got a flat screen terminal, you know, they've got no idea, even if they do know where their PIN, what their PIN number is, of how to put the digits into that flat screen terminal. So that's one of the biggest challenges. And that's why the biometric certainly ticks off everything to make that a successful product.
And with the TaluCard itself, will it represent one bank? Will it be able to share information from many banks, from credit cards? How will that work?
Well, at the moment, we're obviously developing the software and the app and the physical card. The great benefit of the test of Talu is that it can be rolled out as a white label solution. So it can be integrated as an SDK into any financial institution. So if they're looking for a checkbox for inclusion, for example, now the European Accessibility Act has passed in Europe, you know, where digital payments do have to be accessible, you know, we have an out-of-the-box solution that can run along their existing database, however they want to run their payments, rather than integrating in. It can just be a standalone SDK that can run, offer them a biometric card and a tailored app to the needs of those that are visually impaired, and they can start rolling it out immediately. So from that perspective, it's got huge scale opportunity.
Well, where can people find out more about TaluCard and follow your next steps?
Well, we've got a website that's currently up and running, and we do have social media, but as soon as we get through the RNIB tried and tested program, we will be rolling out a lot more about how you can get this product and get people involved into the beta testing and get it out there with the financial institutions.
And how valuable has that partnership with the RNIB been to your work so far with Talu?
Oh, it's been absolutely, and you know, it's so valuable that we couldn't have moved forward without it. I think we'd gotten to a point where we thought we had a successful product, and it was highly innovative and it was going to get out to market. But actually what the RNIB has done is dissected it, you know, from every single avenue, and it's improved the product to the point that we've developed so many more features now and streamlined it to the point that we know that it would be the most accessible product that's on the market now with that type of technology. So yeah, it's been incredible.
Do you have a date in mind, Sam, a hopeful sort of timeline where somebody might be able to find a TaluCard in their wallet?
Well, I think we're coming to the end of the development now, so I would say definitely by the end of this year. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to hearing what comes next for TaluCard. Sam Morgan, founder of TaluCard, thanks for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, Howell.
Now on RNIB Tech Talk, it's time to talk headphones again. Today, we are going to talk about open earbuds and kind of what they provide as an alternative. So this is all about headphones, which allow you to hear your surroundings. For example, we've often talked about Shokz and their brand of bone conduction headphones, whether it's the Open Run Pros for the ability to, you know, do sports activities outdoors, or whether you want the OpenCom 2, which was kind of an equivalent of an office headset with an extendable microphone, which we've demonstrated here sometime a few months ago. Today, we're going to look at Open Earbuds, and they are also from Shokz, these particular ones, but there are other companies that do open ear earphones, so it's not really uncommon now. What are open ear earbuds? Well, the concept is pretty similar to what bone conduction headphones are, in a sense that they allow you to hear background noise around you and be aware of your surroundings. However, the difference is, instead of going on the side of your head next to your ear like bone conduction headphones would, however, the difference is these earbuds sort of don't fully go into your ear, but do touch kind of the hole where in your ear usually a standard earbud would go into. They don't go in as much. They kind of sit there on top, providing you with a decent listening experience while still being able to hear your surroundings at a certain volume. So with bone conduction headphones, you know, you can turn the volume up quite loud and still hear your surrounding because your ear remains completely uncovered. Now, with open earbuds, it's not often the same. So your ear is sort of covered, but not massively. However, it does make a difference when you turn up the volume super loud. So I think volume-wise, still kind of be a bit cautious with that. Today, we are going to look at Open.1 or Open Dots 1 by Shokz. These are open earbuds. They come at a cost of about £170, so not cheap. Bearing in mind with Shokz, a very decent quality product, as I've recently noticed, the durability of their products is quite impressive. So, what do you get with these headphones? Let me tell you, you get a charging case, so kind of like they do with the, your AirPods or a lot of Bluetooth headphones. They come with a little charging case that's the size of a pebble or a very large pill, but I'd say a pebble is probably a more accurate description. Inside the headphone case, you've got two little earbuds, which I'll describe in a minute. The bottom of the case has a charging port, which is USB-C, with the back of the case having the pairing button, which you may sometimes need. Also in the box, you will get a charging cable. You will also get pieces of paper which will have the registration code to register the headphones in the Shokz app. Regarding the app, it is not the most accessible. Certain elements are not really labeled that well or labeled at all. Certainly setting up certain things was not easy. It's the one thing I kind of wish was better here with the Shokz app, but hopefully it's something that will change in time. Kind of a mixture of screen recognition and just exploring the app will probably help you to get as much of it as you realistically can at this point. The features these headphones offer, you've got two things to keep in mind. One is multi-point pairing. This is where you can have these headphones connected to multiple devices at the same time. Now, what's good about it? Well, imagine if, say, you're in the office and you've got your headphones Bluetooth to your work computer so you can hear your screen reader. But let's say you then want to check a message on your phone and you want to be able to do all this without people around you hearing your screen reader, you can do exactly that. So you can hear audio from one device and then start using the other device and the audio shall switch. Now, you can't use audio from two devices at the same time, granted, but to me, the whole point of it is that so I can use both devices connected to Bluetooth without kind of having to turn off Bluetooth on one of these devices in order for the other one to use the same pair of headphones. The other feature to keep in mind with these headphones, because I can appreciate that's not something everyone prefers in headphones, no physical buttons on these. These have touch controls. Now, in majority, they are not too bad. Their particular touch control, which is quite difficult, is what is by default assigned as the play pause button. That touch control, I'm still trying to identify exactly where it is. So that, for me, is probably the only drawback of these. I'm not the biggest fan of the touch controls, just because they're not easy to find. I'll open the charging case and take out one of the earbuds. So these are shaped quite small, and what you basically have is a little rubber cable and it's very short. When I kind of move the cable apart and put the earbud on top of my finger, it kind of feels like a little ring just without the bottom section. You've got the earbud itself, and you've got a little unit on the other side. The way it works is, so the cone part of the headphone, this little comb-shaped unit that kind of feels like a teeny tiny bottle of sorts, that sits on the back of your ear, behind your ear. And then the rubbery sort of cable-like connector goes across your ear until it touches where usually you would put the earbud into your ear. With the earbud being quite big, it will not go into your ear canal. It will instead just sit on top of it. In effect, what you technically have is two little units held together by a rubber cable, which goes across your ear. So it sits in there quite securely behind the back of your ear. I've not found it falling. And because of the way it's designed, it stays in the ear quite comfortably. I've never had an issue of these falling out. Which is quite nice. Each earbud has a volume control. So the left earbud has the volume down control, with the right earbud having the volume up control. And the way you use the volume controls, that's quite simple. So the little cone slash kind of little bottle shaped unit that touches the back of your ear has two flat bits, one at the top, one at the bottom. And you can easily pinch that with your fingers. And when you pinch that, it will make a little beep, which will indicate the volume change up or down, depending on which earbud you touch. The play control, I believe, is somewhere where the rubber cable connects to the little unit at the back of your ear. That's all I can ascertain. I've still not fully figured out exactly where that play pause control sits, which I'd like to, because sometimes I press it accidentally. I can't really then unpress it. For example, I just pressed it and it's currently playing a song and I can't really find the control. I've managed to now pause it, but I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not sure what I exactly pressed or where. So I think the big drawback for me, which I've found workarounds to, is the play pause control, which is a touch control that I've not exactly located. So that's the rough description of these earbuds. And what I've noticed, they're quite comfortable to sleep in. Most earbuds are not, and often they'll end up falling out. I find these aren't too bad for that particular purpose. So if you're looking for some sleep phones, as I like to call them, or sleep earbuds, these might be worth considering as an option, even if it's a slightly pricier option for that particular purpose. The next thing I'm going to show you is what I consider one of the most important parts in Bluetooth headphones of any kind, and that is...
the microphones. Yes, when you always test Bluetooth headphones, there's many things that come into consideration, depending what you want individually in terms of from a Bluetooth headphones pair, whether you want good sound quality, whether you want noise cancellation, or whether you want the exact opposite and you want to be fully aware of your surroundings, or sometimes the microphone can actually play a big part. Now, with most Bluetooth headphones, the microphones are often, I would say, below par. However, they can be quite good in some headphones. I've had headsets which have had decent microphones for what I'd expect there to be. Now, with these headphones, the microphone isn't too bad. If you listen clearly, you can understand what's being said. And I think it also depends what you class as a good microphone for the product you are looking at. Now, for a small pair of earbuds, I would say the microphone's not too bad. I've certainly had earbuds which have microphones considerably trickier to use. So I don't think the microphone on these is too bad. You can let me know what you think of it. It can be quite an interesting one, I think. But I think it does work pretty well if you kind of have realistic expectations of what microphones in the earbuds should be.
So there we go. That is the demo of the Shox Open Dots. Good set of headphones. I think it's something I use quite a lot. Very comfortable. Not much to them at all, but they don't tend to fall out. They stay on your ear slash in your ear quite securely. So hopefully you've enjoyed this demonstration. If you've used them or if you've got another alternative, do let us know, but that is the demonstration of Shox Open Dots here on RNIB Connect Radio. Get in touch with your thoughts, techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
What are some of the everyday uses for AI in your work and personal life? Amelia Hilton has been hearing some examples at the recent Visionary Conference.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and I'm joined by Helen Donkin, the head of marketing at Henshaw's, who is also doing a master's in AI data science. And she is going to join us to talk about some practical applications that are good for beginner users of AI. So, Helen, what are some of the great ways you've seen blind and partially sighted people embrace AI and try and use it to make everyday life a bit easier?
So I have a blind member of staff in my team, and it has absolutely revolutionised her workflows day to day. So from as simple things of putting pictures in newsletters and being able to make sure that they were right ones, through using either built-in in JAWS or through the large language models themselves. One of the very interesting things we've done, it's probably a little bit out of date now, it's about 6 months old, which is scary to think something's out of date within 6 months, but that's the speed that AI is moving, is we did a comparison on alt text and image computer vision work within specialist technology and then the normal language models. So when I say the normal language models, I'm meaning things like Copilot, ChatGPT, Claude and Gemini, which are kind of the normal ones that people would use. And it was interesting to see the different levels of what was worked, which ones hallucinated, which one didn't. She's found that extremely useful. We've used it in helping write letters, helping digest huge documents. We've all had those reports that have landed on our desk that are 100 pages long, and you're like, oh, that's going to take me a long time. But you can use AI to upload it, as long as it's not confidential and has no confidential data in there. Remember your data security. And then you can ask the large language model or the AI that you're using questions on what the content is, and ask it to provide page references so that you can then go and cross-reference it. In my personal life, I went on a big holiday with the kids this summer, and we travelled around Europe, and I had it help me find the non-obvious tourist destinations that in our area to go to with different preferences, and it found some absolutely amazing, not in the guidebook kind of things. So that's a little bit more of a traditional Google aspect and the search, but it's really deeping down into how you do your prompts and how you research that information to have it as a resource partner. For me, day to day, I absolutely love it as a thought partner. It's somebody that I can bounce ideas off, whether they're silly, whether they're not. If I'm wanting to put a proposal in at work, I can write my business case and then ask it to assess it and critically analyse it. And I put my boss's personality in there of what I know they like to see and what they normally ask questions on. And it will act as that person. There's a very famous conversation that comes out in every AI training I've been to, and there's a lot of them, where somebody built their organisational board in AI's personalities and then gave it the board papers and asked it what questions it would raise, and it came up with 80% of what the board actually raised. So imagine going into a meeting with your boss or your appraisal or your PDR or any situation like that and having the answers before they even ask the questions. So it's that forethought. It's great to critically analyse. There's never-ending items. And that's just on the large language side of things. Then you've got image production and video. So we've used it to create training. So it's easier than having to get somebody in for recording. We've used it on simple things like fire marshal training at the moment, but we're looking at how we can use that in a wider piece. But we might be able to do training snippets. One of the things I want to launch in the next couple of months is AI training using the AI, because there's me and we're a big-ish organisation and getting around everybody. But if I can have new starters do a little intro and get snippets to everybody each month to embed the knowledge and the understanding, that to me is key as well.
And I think, like you were saying in the panel earlier today, while for some situations it's scary that so much input comes from user forums, for things perhaps like blind and partially sighted people who want to get other ideas from the community, it's actually a great way to scrape through blog posts, all of the kind of forums where people have asked a question about accessibility or ideas or doing things in a new way, and have all of those ideas presented in a clear way. If people want to do that kind of thing, say like your holiday, if they think, oh, I'd love to go to Athens, but I don't know what's going to be accessible, what kind of setup would you recommend for people?
So for things like that, I would ask it to act as a travel agent. Simple. Give it a role. give it the task, give it the content, and give it how you want the output. So there is a lot of, if you Google it, there's a lot of information of how to follow through and do good prompting. But give it what your preferences are, give it what your accessibility needs are, and ask it to research. And then also, the big thing for me when you're doing any research like this, ask it to provide the references. We all know AI hallucinates. I've had it where I did a report once, and it started coming back with percentages of our VI service users and what their VI diagnosis was, and I was like, where did you get this data from, because I don't even have that. And it was like, oh, I just put placeholder data in, but it doesn't specifically tell you. So I always ask it to give the references. In fairness, ChatGTP has started doing that as standard a little bit better since the new ChatGTP 5 came out, but always cross-reference it. That's my one advice, is always make sure you're in the loop. I really like this morning's comment of human at the wheel rather than human in the loop, so I might have to adapt that into my new sayings. But it is that principle, you are still in control, you still need to cross-reference it, you still need to check it, because it does do things wrong. At the end of the day, large language models are a statistical analysis of a massive verge of data. It breaks down what you put into numbers. It then goes, what are the likelihood of these numbers coming after each other? And then it produces a sentence of more numbers, and then produces it out. So it is just really complex maths at the end of the day. So it's not thinking, it doesn't know, it doesn't have that human knowledge, even though sometimes you can easily forget that you're not talking to a human when you're deep in a chat with it, and especially the way they've been built for that personality element. So just remember that with everything that you do. Go and cross-reference it, double check, and do your own research as well.
And finally, for people who are maybe feeling really overwhelmed and scared about this big new technology that seems to be everywhere that they don't understand, can you give us some examples of how people might have already encountered AI but not realise what it is, and why you'd encourage people to try and be curious and learn more?
So there's day-to-day things that people won't have realised. Your Netflix recommendations, that's AI. Your Amazon You May Likes, that's AI. AI isn't new. It's been around since the 1950s. Yes, it has changed and developed from the traditional machine learning, which was very data-driven, to what we've got now. But it's not that new. And I would just say it is scary. Some days I get scared by it, and I use it a lot, and I've been quite embedded in it for the last 2 years now. And I just think, have a go. Don't try and overwhelm yourself. Just try with one small task, whether it be your holiday planning or you wanting a recipe for something. Find something that, if it does hallucinate or does give you the incorrect answers, it's not going to have a huge impact on you. So start small and then build as you get better and you learn more. But just give it a try and learn and just have a play.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
Let's catch up with a couple of your emails then. We've had a message in from Andrew, who says, "Hi team, after listening to you talk about water and the Meta Ray-Bans, I went online and had a look at the Gen 2. They have an IP rating of IPX4, which means they are splash resistant from any angle. He says they should be fine in light rain, but wouldn't survive heavy rain or submersion." Thanks to Andrew McKay from Aberdeen for that one. I don't really know with the Meta Ray-Bans. They're all good until it starts raining, and then a bit of panic sets in.
That's the big problem. And what do you consider light rain? What do you consider heavy rain too?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be careful with that one. I mean, if you're in the UK, then it could be difficult to say when you can wear them, to be honest. We've also had a message from Alex, who says, "I have tunnel vision and would like to know if there are any smart glasses currently available that could help me get around. Do any smart glasses alert you when you're approaching an obstacle?" This is the thing that we're all waiting for, I'm afraid, isn't it? It's still to come, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the same principle we have, whether you have some vision or no vision, is I think we'd all like some sort of auto video feature where it will automatically tell you, wait, there's a lamppost ahead, or don't, they're going to crash. Whereas at the moment, if you wanted something like that, you're going to have to walk along continuously asking, is there something in front of me? Is there something in front of me? And obviously, that's not practical for anybody. So we're all waiting for that one. Fingers crossed it comes soon.
There's an app on the iPhone that's slowly trying to bridge that app called Scribe Me. And that's slowly kind of getting that idea of a video description or live AI assistance without you having to constantly prompt it. It's early days, but that sort of technology is slowly trying to be designed by people.
At the minute, a lot of these AI services are reactive as opposed to proactive, which means that you've always got to be prompting it. So you've always got to be saying, is there anything in front of me? Is there anything in my way? There's nothing yet that will just, as we've said, basically shout out at you. I do think it's coming. I would definitely keep an eye on things like the Meta Ray-Bans, the Envision Solos. I wouldn't be surprised if they crack this when they can. The problem is, it's not these smaller companies like Envision or Be My Eyes that are the issue here. It's the larger models. So, for example, OpenAI and Google Gemini and all these models that have live AI, they still don't have the reactive side of it. And that's the problem. And these assistive companies can only work with what they've got, essentially. So not at the minute is the short answer, but it's definitely one to keep an eye on. I do think it will come in the not too distant future, if you ask me. And finally, for now, we've had an email from Hillary, who says, I recently heard you talking about AirTags. I'm not very good with technology. I'm completely blind and rely on voiceover. I was wondering if these tags would be any good for identifying my house once I've retired my guide dog next year. Could I put one up by my front door? And so I guess you're talking about navigating to the house that way, making the AirTag play a sound or something. It's an interesting idea. Have you guys got any thoughts on this? Because I've got a couple, but
I've seen people do this in hotels. So what they'll do is hang an AirTag on the inside of the hotel room door. And then when they're walking down the corridor where they knew where the corridor that their room was, they would then play the sound of the AirTag using their phone and kind of follow that. So I have seen something similar done before. How reliable that would be in an outdoors environment where you may not be able to necessarily hear the sound depending on what sort of how busy your area is, that's very dependent.
Exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
Plus, if it's windy, there's a lot of factors that could influence that. You can try it, but I'm not sure if that will necessarily work reliably.
The sound that it plays, considering it's to locate an item, the sound that it plays is surprisingly quiet, if you ask me.
There are other options. Journey, a company Journey, have a new locate range of devices, which apparently does produce a bit better sound.
Yeah, Tile as well is another option they have, and they work on both Android and iPhone. So maybe a Tile, I think the sound on them is not too bad either. It's a difficult one though, because you want something that you can identify, but you don't want other people to, you know, be aroused, if you know what I mean.
I had a few ideas for this one. I did think, I mean, obviously, Hillary, we have no idea where you live, but it might be helpful if you try and find a physical landmark and move away from the idea of technology at all, because at least something like on the pavement or a lamppost or tree or whatever isn't going to change, like we said, you know, if it's windy or rainy. So that would be your best bit. But from a tech perspective, there's an app which I'm sure we've discussed before called What Three Words. So it's WHAT, the number 3, and then words, WORDS. And what you can do is download it. Don't think you have to do anything else beyond that apart from give it permission to see your location. And stand at your front door, and it will give you a three word address for your front door. So it'll be that specific. And then you can save that address. There's a wee button at the bottom of the app that says save. And again, in the same place, another button at the bottom that says add a label. And you can give that a label like front door. And then when you're out and about and you're coming back to the house, you can open the app, search for your front door, and then use whatever navigation app you prefer, Google Maps, Apple Maps, whatever it might be. And that should guide you possibly a bit more accurately than just your normal address would.
The thing that surprised me with the AirTag, because I was looking into this and thinking, well, that, you know, could that work? The other problem with that is that it would be a bit clunky because you've got to get the phone out, go into the Find My app, find the item, and then find the play sound button. And that Find My app is, it's accessible, but it's not as accessible as you'd think it would be. Yeah. But I was thinking, could you say to Siri, you know, where is this, or play a sound on this? It doesn't work, which is surprising, but yeah, that doesn't work. So it could work, but I think it would be a bit of a clunky experience, to be honest. I think What Three Words, I think that would probably be your best shout, to be honest. If you did want a tech solution. You might have already done this, but mention this to guide dogs. Mention this to your local O&M team as well, because sometimes tech isn't always the answer. You know, there might be something else, or there might be something, because they'll see your area, you know, they might be able to recommend something. But a few good options there. I hope that helps, Hilary. Thanks to everyone who's got in touch. If you've got any feedback or anything you want to share, or if you've got any answers to those questions, then get in touch, techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Recently on RNIB Tech Talk, in our mailbox, we received an email from Peter from Australia asking about accessible exercise bikes. And I thought, well, it'll be interesting to answer that and to talk about accessible exercise equipment in general. And I thought I will get my cyclist friend on to talk about this. Chris Wilkins joins me now. Chris, thank you for coming on.
Hi, Hubert. Good to speak to you again.
So before we kind of talk about the exercise equipment itself, it'd be good to kind of get an idea of, A, what is your sight condition and what is your level of sight that you, well, have?
So I've got optic atrophy, something that affects the optic nerves. So I've only got peripheral vision that's blurred, and I can sort of make out shadows and stuff, and then light perception from that. So that's about the level of sight that I've got. So I'm a voiceover and Jaws user.
So I'll be looking at that sort of equipment from, you know, speech output mainly rather than magnification. So, you know, exercise equipment, we often talk about how tricky it is to use. Do you exercise mainly at home, or do you try going to the gym and use their equipment?
I do all of my training at home. I do some bits with the Great Britain Paracycling Squad. I'm sort of, yeah, riding a tandem with them. So all of my training is preset via their coaches, and it goes into a certain app. I do use, obviously, different exercise bikes whenever we are away on holiday as a family. But again, that sort of then throws another added complication in, because it's, again, a new level, a new piece of equipment that I've never used before, and sometimes in foreign countries from a different brand that we may not even get in this country.
So in terms of, you know, exercise bikes themselves, what sort of exercise bike have you got at home that you use probably on a regular basis?
I, at home, have used a variety of different sort of exercise bike slash sort of training equipment. So I've used something called a Watt Bike Atom, and that pairs up with the Watt Bike Hub app. And then I've also used turbo trainers, and they're sort of Wahoo Kicker sort of turbo trainers, which link up to your phone via Bluetooth and speak with a third party, well, yeah, effectively speak with a third party app. And then I've also used a Tax Neo smart turbo trainer.
So when it comes to the Watt bike, how accessible do you find it, and how does it work in terms of accessibility?
In terms of accessibility, so I use a trainer app called Trainer Road, which has preset workouts in on it. And the Trainer Road app itself, I've found very accessible. Obviously, I've said that my coach presets my training, and then that sort of appears in the calendar 2 days in advance of the session via Training Peaks, which is where Great Britain Cycling set the training. But on the Trainer Road app itself, it does have preset training sessions that you can do, and then you have the option to do the session in something we call ERG mode. So that basically means you don't have to be looking at the screen or anything. It's putting on the exact amount of resistance you need to go with sort of the preset power targets it's set for that session. So for instance, if it wants you to do 150 watts, it puts on that level of resistance. So no matter how fast you pedal or how slow you pedal, it's 150 watts. It's definitely consistent. So it makes your training consistent. It does obviously make the training harder when you get into like your higher sort of more maximal efforts, because as your legs start to tie up, obviously it keeps applying the resistance. But then you can also train in sort of standard mode, where you then, from a voiceover perspective, using the Trainer Road app, you can get it to hover over the part on the screen. So I believe it's got time end of the session, like what time you're meant to scheduled end of the session, how many minutes into the interval you are, and then it would also say the current interval, the next interval, and then the subsequent interval after that. So you can sort of keep a track of where you are in the session.
You know, it's always interesting to use that sort of machinery, but it's good to know what's accessible and what doesn't. It seems like some of that stuff is quite premium. But for now, Chris Wilkins, thank you very much for chatting to us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
And that's just about it from us for another week. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. If you like what you've heard, then please get in touch if you've got any comments or questions that you want to share with us. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is that all-important email address. We'll be back with you same time next week, but from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Bubalkovich, Jackie Brown, and Natalie Curran, bye for now.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.